I couldn't understand it. It's not like I don't work. I do. But I don't make enough money to take care of me.
Governor Parnell's decision not to expand Medicaid leaves the poorest Alaskans with no benefit from the new health law. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, December 13th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, searching for ancient shorelines in southeast Alaska.
It had been thought in the past that maybe there weren't large populations here that early, but it was because we never knew where to look.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
Two dead oil-covered seagulls have been found off the coast of St. Lawrence Island. In a release issued today, the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation says that the two freshly dead birds were discovered by offshore hunters on December 10th. No oil slick has been reported in the vicinity of the oiled birds, and no responsible party has been identified. The source of the oil remains unknown. A U.S. Coast Guard plane was dispatched from Kodiak to survey the area around the island, but found no sign of an oil slick. Results are pending from a necropsy on one of the birds. ADEC continues to monitor the situation. In November last year, about a dozen oiled animals washed up on St. Lawrence Island. Officials were not able to pinpoint a cause. House Democratic lawmakers plan to introduce legislation rejecting proposed pay raises for Alaska's governor and other top state officials. Representatives Les Guerra and Scott Kawasaki say it would be wrong to allow for the raises at the same time other areas of the budget are being cut due to declining revenues. The State Officers' Compensation Commission has proposed raising the governor's salary from $145,000 a year to nearly $151,000. The lieutenant governor's salary would go from $115,000 to nearly $120,000. Both would get another 2.5% increase beginning July 1st, 2015, under the proposal. Department head salaries would go from about $136,000 to $146,000. For low-income Alaskans who want to buy health insurance on the federal marketplace, there's a magic number to keep in mind: $14,350. That's the amount of yearly income they would have to earn to qualify for a subsidy to purchase coverage. With the subsidy, they would have to pay very little for health insurance. But below that mark, it's full price. APRN's Annie Feit talked with two Alaskans on either side of that income line and has this story.
Musoke Lukwago has been uninsured for a decade, and when she went to the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center recently to meet with an Affordable Care Act outreach worker, she expected that was about to change.
Oh, let me show you.
At her home in Midtown, she digs through a manila envelope stuffed with papers that were supposed to prove she qualified for a subsidy on healthcare.gov. Instead, she walked out of the office with nothing.
I couldn't understand it. It's not like I don't work. I do. But I don't make enough money to take care of me. Yeah? I need insurance because anybody can get sick.
Musoke is 59. She works a part-time service job and earns less than 100% of the federal poverty level in Alaska, or $14,350. Under the Affordable Care Act, she was supposed to qualify for Medicaid, but a Supreme Court decision allowed states to opt out. Last month, Governor Parnell decided against expanding the program, even though the federal government would pay most of the bill. That means the poorest Alaskans, like Musoke, are left without any benefit from the new health law. Musoke says Parnell's decision is difficult to accept.
He is not elected to be in that office just to, well, I don't know, they're just showing off in those offices. They can go and show off in their homes. They have homes. They should not be in those offices if they are not capable of delivering.
Without a subsidy, a mid-range health insurance plan on healthcare.gov would cost Musoke more than $600 a month, far out of her reach. She can apply for a hardship exemption, so she won't have to pay the tax penalty for remaining uninsured. Keith Ferrari was worried he was going to be in the same situation as Musoke.
I really was.
The Anchorage resident is 61 and works seasonally for his brother's landscaping business. His yearly income puts him right near the federal poverty line. He decided to sit down with his employer in hopes of earning enough next year to qualify for a subsidy.
I really spent time with my brother to see if the $14,000, $15,000 was workable.
It was, and Ferrari's projected income qualified him for a generous subsidy. He purchased a mid-level plan that will cost him just $38 a month.
It was such a burden off of my shoulders.
Ferrari is thrilled with his new insurance plan, but he's frustrated Parnell's decision has left others in similar situations with no reasonable insurance options.
I'm happy for myself, but I can't really fully understand the reasoning that Republican governors have of not accepting, you know, Medicaid expansion. Just looking at the thousands of people within this state that you have a program and they're not going to be able to utilize it.
Governor Parnell understands his Medicaid decision leaves more than 10,000 low-income Alaskans with no access to insurance subsidies.
They're real people. Their health matters.
In a press conference announcing the decision last month, Parnell said he would work to address the problem. He directed the Health and Social Services Department to write a report on the issue.
Clearly, we need to know more about the people in this category and their health care needs, what current services available to them are being utilized, and if different services need to be accessed.
Musoke says she would love to sit down and tell Governor Parnell her story. She says having insurance would allow her to visit a doctor regularly and address health problems early on before they require an expensive trip to the emergency room she can't afford. But she says she has no plans to move to a state that is expanding Medicaid.
Everybody should not run away because, oh, no, we should not be scared. We have to tell these guys that we are here. And actually, it's not like we are begging them. These guys are paid. And you know how they are paid? They pay taxes. These guys are paid from my money. They work for me.
Musoke says being able to go to a doctor is a necessity, not a luxury. She hopes Governor Parnell will reconsider his decision. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Governor Sean Parnell yesterday announced his proposed budget for next fiscal year. He wants to spend less on several big projects next year, including the proposed Susitna-Wetana hydroelectric project. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
Governor Parnell's state budget totals $12.4 billion, which includes drawing $1.1 billion from reserves. Many capital projects saw significant budget cuts, including the Susitna-Wetana hydroelectric project. According to Emily Ford, spokeswoman for the Alaska Energy Authority, $110 million is needed for AEA to complete the necessary prep work for a license to build the dam. Governor Parnell's budget gives them $10 million. The FERC application is currently scheduled to take place in September of 2015, 2 months after the proposed budget ends. In an email statement, Emily Ford says that AEA will be prioritizing field activities and adjusting the licensing schedule as needed, but will continue moving forward. At a press conference following the budget announcement, Governor Parnell gave his reason for cutting so deeply into Susitna-Wetana's budget.
Their timeline for appropriations included having reached land access agreements with the landowners in the area. Those have not been reached, and I told AEA I wanted to see more significant progress on land access agreements before we move forward with committing a significant amount of money.
I asked Governor Parnell what the budget cuts mean for the project timeline and what sort of communication he had received from AEA regarding the status of land use agreements.
They have discussed those, and I've been briefed on it throughout the fall with respect to those issues. I understand negotiations are ongoing. I've also let them know that, again, before I can ask legislators for a significant amount of funding, I need to see significant progress on land access. I mean, there's no sense in moving forward without that.
It's uncertain exactly what kind of impact the budget cuts will have on the research schedule for the Susitna-Watonna project. Land access delayed a number of studies that were supposed to take place this year, and now the inability to access land owned by Alaska Native corporations is hitting the project in the pocketbook. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Bethel man from South Africa remembers life in the country while Nelson Mandela sat in prison.
Growing up in South Africa, I thought that South Africa was mostly a white country, which is a ridiculous thought.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
School districts currently manage their own health insurance plans. They pick their own providers. They decide how much of the premium they want to cover, and their employees can bargain for better benefits. But now a senator from the Matanuska-Susitna Borough is pushing for the state to take over management of school health plans, and a report commissioned by the legislature backs that proposal up as a way of saving money. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Alaska school districts spend $250 million just on employee health care. It's a big number that's only expected to rise, and there isn't one obvious solution to keeping costs down. But a consulting group hired by the Alaska legislature thinks it has a few ideas, and all of them involve putting every one of the state's school employees into the same insurance pool. Melinda Riley with the Hay Group presented to the Senate Finance Committee on Tuesday.
You're saying that all of our employees will go to this network and that as a result achieve better discounts because of the volume of employees that would be utilizing those providers.
The legislature contracted with the Hay Group to find out what might happen if they passed a bill putting the state in charge of managing health plans for Alaska's 16,000 school employees and their dependents. Mike Dunleavy, a Republican senator from the Valley, introduced the legislation this past spring. The Hay Group surveyed all the state school districts, and they interviewed the trust and the insurance companies that currently handle school health plans. Their conclusion is that districts could save up to $34 million every year if the state acted like a broker for schools, without putting them in the state's existing AlaskaCare employee health program. Riley says that
it maximizes the savings through a centrally managed program. So you're getting that low-hanging fruit of leverage, leveraging your size to get the best contracting. But what it also does is it helps to minimize some employee disruption when it comes to plan design.
The Hay Group does see some downsides to that arrangement, though. Districts lose the ability to pick and administer their health plans. A change like that would also affect contract negotiations for teachers. Ron Furr heads the National Education Association's Alaska affiliate, and he thinks the bill would take power away from unionized employees.
The way it's written, it's going to strip the right of education employees to negotiate their health plan benefits and costs. Under current Alaska statutes, health benefits is a mandatory item of bargaining.
The NEA manages plans for about a third of the state's school employees through the Public Education Health Trust. On top of concerns about the bill, they also have questions about the Hay Group report. The NEA is skeptical that districts would be able to achieve the savings projected in the report, and they point out that the study doesn't factor in the $100 million in startup costs the state would need for a takeover. Lawmakers will continue their review of the bill when the legislature reconvenes in January. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Nelson Mandela's funeral is Sunday. The well-known South African leader died last week at age 95. He fought apartheid, which kept him in prison for decades. As KYUK's Angela Denning-Barnes reports, one Bethel resident who grew up in South Africa was deeply moved by Mandela's passing.
My name is Wouter Redlinghuis. I live in Bethel, but I am originally from South Africa.
Wouter moved to Bethel about a year ago after his wife got a job here. He was born in 1977, and by then, Mandela had already been in prison for over a decade.
It's very difficult to talk about South Africa and not talk about race, which is always a very sensitive issue.
Wouter says he saw segregation as a white person.
Growing up in South Africa, I thought that South Africa was mostly a white country, which is a ridiculous thought because only 10% of South Africa, even less than 10% of South Africa's population is white. But segregation was so effective and so strictly enforced that everywhere we went, all we saw was white people. I remember the signs very clearly, Europeans only. Really, the only interaction you had with anyone non-white was either someone working in your house as a cleaner or someone working in your garden. Schools, shops, malls, everything was completely segregated. So it's difficult to imagine, but you lived in this bubble that was completely outside of reality of what was going on.
Wouter later learned what was going on. He didn't hear about Mandela while he was in prison because political prisoners were not allowed to communicate with the outside world. Mandela was eventually released from prison in 1990 after 27 years. It took continued international pressure and the country's new government leadership, which saw apartheid as unsustainable. Wouter says leading up to his release, you could see Free Nelson Mandela spray painted on walls all over South Africa.
I was young at the time. I think I was 14, maybe 13, but I remember it as it was yesterday. It was a big event. Everyone came together and watched it. When he was freed from prison, as he walked out of the gates, out of the prison. And that is the first time I can consciously remember seeing him on television.
Another big event Mandela spurred, bringing the country together, was the day South Africa won the Rugby World Cup in 1995. Wouter says he'll never forget it. Rugby was largely considered a white sport, but was publicly supported by Mandela.
It was the first time I could remember being proud to be a South African. It's a moment that I will always treasure, and I don't think there's a drug in the world that could make you feel as good as we all felt that day.
The event was documented in the movie Invictus. Wouter still has family in South Africa that he visits once a year. He says it's still segregated, not by law anymore, but by social status and financial means. He says there's still tension between racial groups. But the country continues to move forward in part due to the life's work of Nelson Mandela. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Rural Energy Enterprises, supplying Alaska dealers with fuel-efficient Toyo stoves and Oil Miser heaters for more than 26 years. Local dealers can be found at rural-energy.com. The Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnickarm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Matsu Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnickarm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Rachel Waldholtz. This week on AK, ancient shorelines. Most of us like to know something about our family history, and we might want to get some idea of who was here before us. In southeast Alaska, some scientists and university students are looking for evidence of early human habitation, and they're finding it. As Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports, they first have to figure out where the shoreline used to be.
It's like a sandy loam that's just got a lot of organic.
Dave DeMore digs into a hole on the Juneau campus of the University of Alaska Southeast. He's looking for evidence that this spot, about 100 feet above sea level, was once an ocean shore.
This looks like it's organic.
Yeah, and then you
over that
sand.
Beach. There's that beach.
Damore is a soils expert with the U.S. Forest Service's Pacific Northwest Research Station. He's one of the scientists working with university students to map Juneau's ancient shorelines.
Generally, if I have my rubber boots, this is the approach.
They're hard to find because of the region's ever-changing geography. The weight of huge glaciers depressed the Earth's crust. Their forward movement created raised bulges of land. Their melting allowed the surface to rise. And then, there's plate tektonics. Early residents, Tlingit Indians or their predecessors, lived along these shores. So finding their camps and villages, sometimes hundreds of feet above today's sea level, can lead to new discoveries.
One of those 3-gallon buckets.
Dan Monteith is an anthropology professor at the university. He's scooping water out of another hole where he hopes to find something interesting.
We're going around following up different river drainages or cut banks looking for evidence of old ancient raised marine beaches.
They've already found some. Monteith walks up a small creek to an eroded bank. There, sticking out of the soil, are small, dirty white seashells.
By collecting shell and other things from those areas, then we can radiocarbon date those and get kind of a fixed point of when that was a beach at different points in time.
The technique was developed on Prince of Wales Island. Forest Service geologist Jim Bechtel says it can be used to make an educated guess of where early residents used to live.
Just as you and I today would camp within 2 to 3 feet above high tide, so were folks in the past. And then if you had food and you had good shelter and good moorage, that's the kind of places we would camp.
Bechtel, archaeologist Risa Carlson, and other scientists began their effort about 4 years ago. On an early outing, they headed up an estuary and into the forest to where waves lapped the shore thousands of years before.
And we dug down about 50 centimeters and dug into the top of over a meter of charcoal and tools and other things that were left there by the inhabitants at that place.
Radiocarbon dating showed those items to be about 10,000 calendar years old. Bechtel says he and other scientists used the technique to find archaeological material on more than 70 Prince of Wales Island sites. About 10 have been dated to around that same time, showing Southeast's first residents were well established by then.
It had been thought in the past that maybe there weren't large populations here that early, but it was because we never knew where to look. And this is giving us a whole different way of where to look and what to look for.
Back at the university, Monteith and his students record GPS coordinates for each hole they've dug.
Did you guys get latitude longitude on any of the other test pits we did?
The group has dug in other areas of Juneau. It's also inventoried known tribal sites in a bay north of town. Student Bernadine Diasis says that helped her learn some of her own history.
That was really important for me, to get a perspective of, you know, how the Tlingits were, where they were in this area, because I'm Tlingit myself.
Are you hoping to find some evidence of where people used to live?
Yes, we are. We know for sure that they've been in this area, so it's kind of like a treasure hunt for me.
The effort will continue for many years, expanding to other parts of the region. For AK, this is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we traveled to the community of Shaktulik, a coastal village about 125 miles east of Nome on Norton Sound.
My name is Eugene Siksik, and I live in Shaktulik, Alaska, and I'm currently the mayor, and I'm a commercial fisherman all my life. We're about 260 to 270, and we moved to this present location in 1975, and we had moved because of flooding and erosion that started back in 1963 and up to today. The village is laid out in blocks with four houses or four lots per block, And it is a very straight village with one street down the middle, but it made it very easy for electrical and water and sewer lines to be brought in at a later date, which we currently enjoy today. We do participate in commercial herring fishing, commercial crab. There's roughly six crabbers, and most of it is most of the fishermen. We do have 31 active fishing permits in the community, so it's commercial salmon fishing. I guess what's most impacting is the late falls and no ice in the Norton Sound, and which used to buffer the storms that occur. You know, there's concerns that maybe the next storm we will have some overtopping and water into the community from the ocean side because of the continued erosion. I like living in Shaktuk because it's home, and we can do our subsistence during the summer. And, you know, also do subsistence in the winter. We're not that much into trapping today, but that was something that I enjoyed doing in the old days. And we also have winter ice crabbing through the ice, and that you can make a little bit of living there.
Eugene Asiksik is mayor of Shaktulik. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, email news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Ed Schoenfeld, Monica Goki, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Rachel Waldholz.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Philip Manning in Talkeetna and Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge and Kristen Spack are our web producers. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline is ready to help you succeed in your decision to quit tobacco. Take advantage of proven successful free resources. Trained quit coaches will provide support services to help you quit for good with confidential counseling. There's free nicotine replacement therapy and a tailored quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.